Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
Yes, yes, let's do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And this is the place where we are going to do our best to do it right. This is where all the folks who want to be about change, all the folks who are doing the work on the battlefield, can come together and talk about that work. They're fighting for democracy, for economic justice, for political power. And they're doing it in so many ways across this country and actually across the globe. So we want to welcome a special guest here in town that was able to come into the studio. But before we get into that, I do want to say that last week I let you know that Martha West had a heart attack. She seems to be doing okay. They have transferred her out of ICU, and she's in one of those facilities to help her get stronger. So I will definitely keep you updated on that. Martha West, who is in her mid-90s, was the first one to tell me that the current location of Harrisville State University, which was the original Vashon High School, told me that the reason that the entrance is on the what would be the backside and not the Market Street side, which would be the busy intersection, is because they didn't want white people who were coming from downtown to see black students going in and out of that building. So I thought that was very interesting bit of tidbit, but that's part of the history of St. Louis, and the person who we have today is going to talk about some of that history, but not all of it, because that's a whole nother mini programs. But I'd like to welcome in the studio Walter Johnson. Walter is a professor of history at Harvard University. He is a prolific writer of books and, you know, many articles. But today we are going to be focusing on what I think is a seminal work of his around St. Louis. It's called the...
Oh, you're looking at me. I was looking down at the ground. So, The Broken Heart of America.
The Broken Heart of America. And I want you to get, before I officially welcome you, Walter, welcome to the show. And I'm not going to do a whole lot of introduction of you because that would take a while. But again, prolific writer, professor of history, and just a human rights advocate of extraordinaire. And so we are so happy to have him in St. Louis. And I'm going to talk about the fact that you hear quite a bit, probably more than Harvard would like. And I'm thinking at one point they're going to say, since you like St. Louis so much, why don't you let them pay your salary?
So do you want to read the disclaimer before I say anything?
Yeah. The opinions expressed on Black Radio Hall of Fame are those of the program host and not necessarily the opinions of Harrisville State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame.
I just want to indemnify you against my opinions.
Thank you.
And my vocabulary. So. I don't know. I mean, it's a strange situation for me in that I have I've been able to move and to some extent work in St. Louis in a way that I haven't any other place that I've ever been or worked on. But of course, I don't live here, and so that's and my ability to do that is based on the generosity of people here, like you and Percy Green, Tef Poe, people who have vouched for me and taken me places that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to go. And so I'm really grateful for that, and that's been in a lot of ways life-changing for me, both in enabling me, I think, to write and think about St. Louis in a different way, but also I think in a pretty profound way has helped me imagine a different approach to left or radical politics, just based on seeing the kind of work that people were doing here. So there are certainly moments where I think Harvard would be happy to trade me away. I'm not sure that my trade value is that high right now, you know. It might be for like a seventh round draft in 2036 or something
You're
like that.
You're being modest. Yeah. And I do want to take you back to the point that you made about, you know, what people here have done for you, but I think it's a reciprocal relationship, because I think you being here and the project that we worked on in terms of really digitizing and getting the archival documents for the Organization for Black Struggle into the Missouri Historical Society, that really made us, put us on a course to take that project much more seriously, and you devoted some students to help us do that, and so for that I think we'll be eternally grateful, because it did help us create some momentum around that. And I think for organizer activists and folks in the academy for years to come, we hope that that will be a resource there for them.
Oh, that's great. That's really nice. I mean, that it was I've taken a lot away from, you know, learning from people here. And one of the things that somebody said to me at some point was, people's stories are precious, that you can't just take them away and not leave anything behind. And so it has been a goal of mine to try to leave some kind of institutional, you know, not an institutional footprint of Harvard, but at least a trace of some of the resources that Harvard has, and use it to develop resources here and infrastructure, but also just, you know, a terrific project like that, which is going to benefit not only you. I mean, probably you were able to move a lot of boxes out of your office, but future historians, you know.
Yeah. And I do want to mention, I think one of the reasons that people keep asking you to come back here or to be on webinars is because of the writing that you've done about Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that you were born and raised here. So you have a perspective, but I think the perspective is unique because it's coming from a white male who's been educated in some of the, you know, the best universities. And so I think there's some respect for that, because I don't know where else are we getting that kind of unique viewpoint about Missouri. So and we're going to delve into that in a minute, but I do want to get this piece out of the way, because we've been talking a lot and I've been writing a lot about diversity, equality and inclusion, the ODEI stuff. And, you know, at one point, not too long ago, Harvard was at the center of the turmoil about that, based on what happened with Claudine Gay. So how has the dust settled from that in terms of where the university is around diversity and inclusion?
Do you want to read that disclaimer again? Here's what I'll say about that. I think that there have been four talented and honest and engaged black women targeted at Harvard by people who were legit evildoers, as yet unknown. And I don't think that the institutional response at Harvard has been sufficient, or really even that there has been an institutional response. And I think that has to do with a lot of things that are around different kinds of felt legal imperatives that the university feels, or fear of their donors that the university feels. None of those imperatives seem to me to have to do with truth-telling or with courageous behavior. And so you have, I guess you can't hear a silence, but the university has been nearly silent about that. And while I have, I guess probably what I would want to do is distinguish between a attack on DEI and what I think is just simply an unprincipled racist attack on black women. Because I have, at this point, I think philosophical and political differences with the DEI bureaucracy. But the way that the initials or the word, you know, DEI are used in right-wing and increasingly in middle-of-the-road white thought is really just as a code word for having to do with the history and or interests and or critical thought about black people. And I, you know, that kind of attack, I think, is scandalous. Mm-hmm. Apart from whatever institutions are doing in the name of DEI, and I do not think that Harvard has responded in a way that showed any kind of integrity or courage to that.
So, you know, that's troubling to hear, but there is a bright light that I can tell you in case you didn't know. Last month I had on the show one of the co-authors of Did That Just Happen, which is about diversity, and your colleague Stephanie Spender Amacher was one of the guests.
Oh, right.
And so she, when I said what has happened, she said one of the things that has happened is the whole athletic department has submitted to the training that they do, her and her colleagues. And of course, for me, you don't even think about Harvard as being somebody that's got a sports program. So I'm like, oh wow. So that commitment came from a particular department, which I think is promising, because maybe another department would say, let's do that. But so yes, the overarching administration probably is not doing all it can, but you know, people like yourself who are in positions where they can say, yes, I think this is a good thing, they seem to be moving forward. So I think that's positive motion. So I just want to let my listeners know that there was an intentional date for having Walter Johnson here. Two things. One is that we are, tomorrow will be the anniversary of the lynching of Frances McIntosh here in St. Louis downtown. And then in another week, it's going to be the anniversary of the World's Fair, the 1904 World's Fair. And so both of those have some, not just some tinges of racism, but some definitely cornerstones for racism. And so I just want to say for the Frances McIntosh lynching, Walter and I co-authored an article that went to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Despite the fact that there was two names on there, decided to leave mine off. And so Walter wanted to fight and say, no. But I'm telling Walter, this is the reality of folks in St. Louis. We have to fight for every damn thing, even to have your name on an article. So I said, I'm not going to waste my time. But Walter persisted. And so they decided, since it was already printed in the print paper, that they would include my name on the internet version. But you know, I'm using that example because it's so embodies what happens here in St. Louis with black people who are struggling for their existence, for their to be included, for their contributions. I mean, it's just like the everyday uphill fight, and that to me was one way that it, you know, totally embodied the way that we get treated here in St. Louis. But I do want to start with the lynching of Frances McIntosh, April 28th, 1836, and this is a there's so many things to say about that particular lynching, but one of the things I wanted people to know is that it became that and the lynching of John Buckner over there in Valley Park were part of the Equal Justice Initiative and the soil collection ceremonies that's been done all over the country. And the way this is done for people who haven't heard about it is where you are in your particular city or town. If there is a lynching there, then you get soil from that lynching spot. And you save one for the local folks, and then you send one to Alabama where the museum is. But you also then put a marker there so that people know this is what happened here, and this is part of the history of this particular geography. Well, sad to say that there's no markers there for Francis McIntosh or for John Buckner. Both of these were free black men. These were not slaves. They, you know, runaway slaves. They were free black men who were lynched in the case of McIntosh. He was actually burned alive, and they left the charred stump there as a reminder of the terrorism that could be invoked for other black folks. John Buckner was hung from a bridge near Valley Park, and those folks in Valley Park said, ain't no way we gonna put a marker up anywhere for a lynching, because now that's like a little walkway that white people have to go through, and they don't want to see that ugly piece of history. So talk about why you thought that Francis McIntosh's lynching was important enough to write about.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing to say just about the EJI, the Equal Justice Initiative, and the markers is that they have two markers in Birmingham at the museum. That will be the marker that will stay at the museum, and that is also the second marker is the marker that the municipality or county has refused to accept. And so the city of St. Louis in that case, or Valley Park, their refusal to accept the marker is actually memorialized now in Birmingham, Alabama, and, you know, in what I think is a really, really powerful, a powerful project. The McIntosh lynching was notorious at the time and was the subject, in part of a speech that Abraham Lincoln gave later that year in Springfield, Illinois, in what's called the Lyceum Address, where he talked about the growing spirit of, lawlessness, mob violence in the nation. I think it was arguably the first kind of lynching of the, I don't even know what to say, the classical sort in the United States of tying somebody to a tree and burning them alive. But it was also, I think, really emblematic in the history of the city of St. Louis. So Francis McIntosh was a free man of color, as you said, and was a hand aboard a steamboat. And that Mississippi Valley trade that, you know, ran up and down the river, was a lot of the labor in that trade was enslaved, but also there were very many free people of color. And free people of color, the further and further you went south, are more and more threatening because free people of color are, living refutations of the idea that African American people can only be productive in slavery. And they are living contradictions to the notion of slavery and white supremacy as having the same kind of shape as being the same institution. And so from the 1820s on, beginning in South Carolina in 1822 after the Denmark Vesey uprising, you start to get special laws regulating the behavior of free people of color. And those laws take on, I think, a particularly, I mean, you know, there's nothing that is gentle or subtle about those laws, which require free people of color, free seamen, black seamen, free black seamen, to be locked up when their ships docked in
Charleston. And let me just say that, stop you. That's S-E-A-M-E-N. Not S-E-M-E-N. Okay, y'all?
You got to read that disclaimer again. Sorry about that.
No, when I heard semen, I'm thinking, you said black semen. I'm like,
what? You're like, wow, this show's getting deep fast. Yeah, that has also been very, very carefully regulated in the history of the United States.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I cannot believe, honestly, that it's not me who's cutting up and making this show inappropriate. So, it's going to take me a little while to find my my pattern of thought here again. So at the time of Missouri statehood, 1820, 1821, there are provisions put in the Missouri Constitution that are clearly designed to limit the immigration and citizenship of free people of color in the new state of Missouri. And those throughout the period up to the Civil War are, there's a set of laws which are targeting free people of color. And free people of color were seen as particularly threatening in the Midwest by non-slave holding white people who thought that they were gonna, you know, that they were competition for labor. And so that's the sort of history that McIntosh himself represents. Now, McIntosh, the person, was just, he was an ordinary guy on a break from work walking along the levee who got, run down by a couple of, you know, self-appointed watchmen and fought back. And, you know, there's, when somebody runs you down on the levee and tackles you, it seems only natural, probably, to a lot of people to fight back, and that's what McIntosh did, and in the process he killed one of these people, one of these white men, and got taken to the jail, and then pulled out of the jail, and lynched outside in the side of the state capitol. And that tree, as you said, was there for years, and sort of a reminder, I think, to anybody coming into St. Louis from the east of what it meant to be there, a sort of a marker marking, you know, the gateway to the west, so to speak.
Hmm. Yeah. That certainly, most people I don't think know about that lynching still. It would be helpful to have that marker there.
It would be right across the street from a Hooters. I mean,
Chestnut.
Yeah, the indignity is palpable.
Yeah, but you know, I'm thinking, you know, we had the ceremony there in Keener Plaza, which is close enough. Something could be put there. So I'm really going to find out from the people with the Reparative Justice Coalition what is the issue for St. Louis. I understand Valley Park. Because the mayor, Tashara Jones, was actually at the ceremony. Mm-hmm. And so she understands the importance of this. So it could be, you know, some kind of bureaucratic snafu. I don't know, but we need to find out. Because I don't want St. Louis to be in the same breath as a Valley Park in terms of why they don't want it there. So,
and with all due respect to the city government, I mean, I think that, as you were saying with the newspaper forgetting to put your name on the editorial, the bureaucratic snafus seem to take on a particular kind of pattern when viewed from, you know, 5 feet away.
I wish I could say that that was a bureaucratic snafu, but
that's what I'm saying.
My critique of the post disgrace, I'm sure that that was intentional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So moving right along, because I do want us to talk about the book, because for me, the book is one of the ones that I have kept because it's a reference point. A lot of the books I give away because once you read them, you want to share it. But this one, you have to keep going back and looking at stuff. So I want to start.
You could always just buy a second copy and share.
Yeah, if I had those kind of resources, yes, I could. But I want to start with the title.
Yeah.
And also the book cover, because the book cover is very interesting because it has a picture of the unfinished legs of the arch not quite coming together. And I'm sure there's some symbolism in that, and so you can explain that. But also, it looks like, and it could be the angle of the camera, it looks like one of the legs is white and the other leg is black. So that could have been some photoshopping. I don't know. So talk a little bit about the design of the book cover and the title itself, because to me, it is, I mean, we are a broken heart. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's kind of sad sometimes when you read about St. Louis and what has happened to us and what has not happened to us, to be more frank, because even when we look at, you know, map and decline that, you know, Colin Gordon did, I mean, if ever there was a visual justification of how we got here, that is in that book. And I just, you know, I just keep wondering, are these folks who are part of the whole racial confederacy, Southern Confederacy, are they so obsessed with keeping black folks and brown folks down and white working class people down, that's all of their energy is going towards that as opposed to developing and looking at new ways of doing stuff. So let's talk about that cover first.
All right.
So where did you get the title and then the design?
No, I mean, it's an interesting story, at least to me. They are actually related. And what was happening was I had come up with a lot of titles for the book, and I can't even remember them all. Most of them had the word Babylon. And, you know, I mean, I literally...
I'm sure your publisher wouldn't too mad with that.
I usually start a little far away and then kind of home in a little bit. So I wanted to call it the Book of Habakkuk, which is the Old Testament book that talks about Babylon and, you know, how Babylon was cursed. But I finally got to the idea of the Broken Heart of America as a subtitle. And then the publisher sent it back and said they wanted to use it as a title. And they wanted this subtitle that they put on it, which you'll notice that I didn't repeat when I read it, because it's called St. Louis and the Violent History of the United States. And for me, the word violence was not sufficient, really, to what I wanted to talk about, because as I try and relate in the book, I want to talk much more concretely about imperialism, about capitalism, and about racism, white supremacy, black removal, Indian removal, etc. So we were going back and forth about whether the word violence was sufficient. And then they sent me a mock-up of that cover with that image on it. And my response was basically to send them an email that said, y'all do whatever you want to do. You obviously know better than I, you know, because that photograph is so fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is fantastic in showing a break in the arch, as you say, in showing kind of a very high contrast between black and white. And, you know, if you want to hold on to some kind of hope, and I do not mean hope in the, I do not mean hope as a synonym for optimism. I mean hope as a discipline, right? Hope as a knowledge that we've been defeated before and we are going to be defeated again, but that we have to keep struggling. If you want to hold on to that, the thing that I see, you can see in that also is the unfinished character of that. And I think that George Lipsitz, who was a mentor of mine, a historian of St. Louis himself, a one-time resident of St. Louis, he says that St. Louis is the right place for all the wrong reasons. And that's the vision that if I, you know, when in my most hopeful moments, I think the conditions in St. Louis are extraordinary in the degree of abandonment and violence and derogation and sheer disregard on the part of propertied white people for their neighbors, but also extraordinary in the sense that people in St. Louis have been, black people in St. Louis, poor people more generally in St. Louis, have been pushed down so far that I think the conditions are there for regeneration. I see that when I drive around the neighborhoods on the north side and you see, you know, the beautiful buildings, the beautiful abandoned buildings, but also the kind of extraordinary possibility for some kind of retaking of territory on the north side. I mean, you know, as you know, we could open up our computer right in this room right now and buy a house on the north side for whatever, $1,000, $250, and it would be run down. But, you know, there's a possibility there for retaking space. And so for me, there's, you know, I always want to kind of hold on to that part of the dialectic. Now, I will say the degree of indifference in, and this is the same indifference that I grew up with in Colombia, the degree of indifference to black humanity, to black suffering, and to basic decency that exists in parts of St. Louis County, in parts of Missouri, in parts of our country is to me still surprising. And I guess in a lot of ways I'm still kind of trying to work out, you know, the contradictions that became so apparent to me when I was like maybe 12, 13 years old. And I was living among moralistic white people, people who seem to be talking about right and wrong all the time, and yet living in a place that was so manifestly unjust that I feel like I'm still trying to sort that out. And of course that's a lot of the history of St. Louis.
Yeah. But I remember in 71 when I was fresh out of college and very radicalized, and I looked at the difference between Kansas City and St. Louis, and I said, St. Louis got it going on culturally, you know, that's where I want to go. And over time, I kept saying to myself, what is missing here? What don't these people understand? And said, to your point about, I don't exactly know what it is, but you know, initially you think maybe people don't know. And so then you start on this whole thing about like the conditions black people live in, you know, the policies that put them there, and you thinking, okay, this is going to touch the heart and soul of, you know, these folks in power. And it never does. And so we just keep, you know, repeating the same thing over and over again. So now we have a city that at one point was what, third largest in the country at the turn of the century, to now the actual population is less than Kansas City's. So when I thought I was going to the big city, now it's not so big anymore. So it's just like this place seems to be entrenched in just old thinking, and not just old backwards thinking, but old parochial, patriarchal, racist thinking, which is just, I think, puts a stranglehold. So it may have something to do, Walter, with why you call the Louisiana Purchase Exposition an imperial project. Because I think when you talk about maybe violence in the title was not sufficient, but when I read that, first read it, I had expanded it not to just the physical violence, but policies and laws and practices that are also violent.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I do think one of the things that started to come through very strongly to me as I did the research on the book was the extent to which the economic and political focus of what I would call racial capitalism in St. Louis and in the Midwest more generally in relationship to black people was removalist. And it actually had a lot more to do with the history of the way that white settlers interacted with Native Americans than it did with slavery. So there was always slavery in St. Louis, but slavery was not a big part of the economy. And the dominant attitude, the dominant sort of racial governance was this effort to keep free people of color out of St. Louis. And that attitude eventually took the shape of the Dred Scott decision, which I would argue is both a pro-slavery decision, but it is a decision that is eliminationist in relationship to free people of color. The idea that free people of color have no rights that the white man is bound to respect, right, is an eliminationist idea. And so one of the things I try to argue or to trace in the book is the way that at various moments in the history of St. Louis, various moments of capitalist economic development with different kinds of imperatives and different ways of accumulating money, they all still kept on culminating in the large-scale displacement of black people, whether that's the East St. Louis Massacre, which came out of an industrial labor conflict in 1917 and led to the expulsion of 5,000 black people across the river to St. Louis, Missouri, whether that's the real estate capitalism and state-sponsored economic development of the interstate highway system that followed the Second World War, which led to the destruction and displacement of 20,000 people from the ground that we're on right now in Mill Creek Valley.
Exactly.
Whether that's the explosion of the Pruitt-Igoe housing project, or really whether that's the kind of harrowing effects of for-profit policing and mass incarceration in North City and North County today, there's a series of removals. And I think that is more a Midwestern pattern than a Southern pattern. And I think that is, it's got a particular hard edge. You know, the idea of the white man's country is the idea that black people just shouldn't be here. And I think if you look at the way the city of St. Louis, like many Midwestern cities, is set up around bypass routes and around segregated, you know, even the infrastructure is segregated. And the infrastructure was intended to be segregated and segregating. And so I do think that produces a kind of deniability, but a paranoid deniability among the white population. And I think, you know, one of the things I try to think about occasionally is, well, why is it that white people in this society are so fearful? Why is it that white people are so fearful at a time in our history when the unemployment rate is almost as low as it's ever been in the United States? Real wages are actually growing in the United States. Right, people who are living, you know, the economic conditions for working class white people in this society, and certainly for middle class and upper class white people, are actually improving. And yet, these people are paranoid. They're armed up. Their lives are characterized by fantasies that black people are going to come out at North St. Louis en masse and take away their property and, you know, steal their flat screen televisions or whatever. And I think of that kind of outsized fear that has these people putting in alarm systems and arming up their houses and as a psychological recognition of the inequality in our society, as part of the psychological recognition of what lies hidden, what they try to keep hidden every day, but everybody knows, which is that the society is built upon and continues to be dependent upon. It's built upon genocide and slavery and continues to be dependent upon racial capitalism and, you know, you could argue mass incarceration, and that's where the fear comes from. The fear is the irrational fear.
So you devoted a whole chapter with a title that comes right out of the United States Supreme Court decision against the Scotts, and I had the granddaughter of Dred Scott here a few weeks ago talking about that legacy. But here's the thing, Walter. Okay, I can understand that level of thinking, that consciousness back in the 1800s, where you've been socialized to think that black folks are inferior and that they, you know, are whatever, not worthy of having citizenship, and everything speaks to that. But as we go on, and black folks are, you know, going to college, they come inventing stuff for the benefit of all people, and then you think, okay, why are we still holding on to that backward notion when all the proof is there? I mean, you're not going to put the genie in the bottle. I mean, we're here. We obviously are here to stay because we don't have no damn where else to go. The imperialists haven't, like, you know, contaminated. But because if we don't believe something different is going to happen, then what are we talking about here?
Yeah. So the way, I guess, I mean, it's a profound question, right? And it's one that stretches to dimensions of knowledge that are philosophical and are psychological and are spiritual that I'm, you know, I can't always get there. But what I can say is this. I think that the history of racial capitalism has stages. And I don't mean one stage after another, but there's different modes of capitalism and there's different forms of racism different kinds of templates for racial governance. And I think that what we see now is a kind of a, what I would call a dialectic of exceptionality and disposability. And that is one that is, in some ways epitomized by DEI in elite institutions. So what you have, I think, is a degree of incorporation of black elites in elite institutions. And nobody at this point, I think, well, I can't say nobody because I have even colleagues who are interested in doing this. I don't even know what to say anymore. Because I wanted to say nobody is interested in trying to make a eugenic argument about racial difference. But I actually think that increasingly people are interested. So people are interested in going back to that. Right now, that is an emergent fringe position, but it is coming to be a dominant position. The dominant position right now is a kind of qualified inclusion that is the integration of elite and some other institutions that is predicated on the exclusion and disposability of the large mass of people. And I will be totally honest with you in saying that I did not fully understand that until I came to North St. Louis. Mm. And so I have been in elite institutions for a good part of my life and had spent a lot of time and lost a lot of friends and, made some number of institutional enemies fighting to transform those institutions into different kinds of simulacra versions of democracy. And then I came to North St. Louis and started to see what was happening here, and I thought, well, I've been fighting for this shit in universities all my life, and it never has and never will touch this place unless we have a different kind of politics. And so that's what I mean by a dialectic of exceptionality. Like, oh, well, here are the people that we're going to bring into this institution, and we're going to put on the board of directors, and we're going to listen to them up to the very moment that we stop. Mm-hmm. And that moment when we stop is going to be the moment when somebody says something about structural transformation rather than about diversity, inclusion, and belonging. Mm. And that to me, I think, is kind of where this moment in our politics has got stuck. Mm. And the moment, that's where we got to change.
If you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are here with Walter Johnson, who is a professor of history, as you can probably tell from his remarks, at Harvard University, but don't hold that against him. He's the author of a profound book called
The Broken Heart.
The Broken Heart, because I always want to say heartbreak, because it is heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking.
The Broken Heart of America, and it really puts St. Louis at the center of this. And, I was thinking about your last response about where we are, and when I had a conversation with Judge Mason here, and he was saying, I know you're having Lynn Jackson on as the granddaughter, but and I often pull out that quote about, there's no rights. I say that. He said, you need to read the whole
decision.
And I did, and of course it just was more infuriating. It was like really, you're talking about heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It was heartbreaking that somebody had that view at that time about black people. Cause if that was a prevailing view, I don't know where we would be. We probably wouldn't even be here. But what I'm thinking is one of the interesting things that he said is, the activist community needs to get that off the books, because that is a ruling that's still there. He said, so you may think it's old, and I'm like, okay, I got plenty other things to do than to, But then guess what happened with Alabama? They reached back to a 18 something 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 thing. I'm thinking, okay, maybe this is a valid fight, because I can just imagine them coming back saying, okay, I know y'all think y'all citizens, but we getting ready to invoke the good old Dred Scott decision.
Well, the Dred Scott decision has for some time had a life on the pro-life right, because one of the arguments there was that pro-life, that Roe versus Wade, as jurisprudence had made illegal, had taken away the rights of a class of citizens in the same way the Dred Scott decision had. Now, that's a version of a right, far-right interpretation of Dred Scott that frames the decision as a mistaken one. But I agree with the idea that we could potentially be facing, really, really extreme jurisprudence. I mean, I think honestly the first kind of extreme jurisprudence that I think that we would see coming out of the Supreme Court, or not the first, but the next step, could be something around the limitations of the 14th Amendment in relationship to women's rights. So, Justice Scalia, before he died, was giving speeches that talked about the fact that the 14th Amendment is equal protection under the law for men. And that in the absence of an Equal Rights Amendment, that there's not a constitutionally protected, women are not a constitutionally protected category at all. And so I do think that there is always room for terrible reactionary captures of our history. So, a longer version of this talk that I'm going to give tomorrow night has a thing at the beginning about the German Jewish political philosopher, Marxist, Walter Benjamin, or Walter Benjamin, or you can take those four different formulations and mix them up however you want. Walter Benjamin, whatever. but about his vision of history, and he says that under the conditions of fascism, even the dead are not safe. And what he means by that is that there's a constant kind of stripping out and summoning up and reworking of the past, almost like you're digging up the graveyard and you're pulling out the ghosts, you're pulling out the things that have been hidden or covered over by history and trying to resuscitate them. And I think that's in some way what we're starting to see with these battles over history, these efforts to come up with the kind of absurd versions of history in which the most important thing to do is to make sure that nobody ever says that any white person did anything wrong, because that might make the little white kids in the class feel bad. Because I want to say, well, why are you imagining, number one, that you can't find righteous white people in history? And number two, why can't your little white kid identify with somebody else's heroism? Mm-hmm. Right? Why can't we imagine that as a goal of education? Mm-hmm. But these arguments that we're having to take on are so infantile in their approach to history, and yet they're increasingly, we're forced to engage them. They're increasingly dangerous.
But also, I'm thinking about this whole erasure of black history, black. Because it's painful, and you don't want the little white kids to feel bad about their ancestors and what they did. But it's so insidious, Walter, because, you see it through, even I remember when they were building the federal courts, and the architect and whoever was trying to put together the interior design, and they wanted in one of the floors a mosaic that included an inscription from Percy Green versus McDonnell Douglas, which is a landmark case for St. Louis and really put us on the map in terms of racial discrimination. And the judges got together and said, no, we're not doing that. So it's like every time when there could have been a chance for them to lift up and support, protect black citizenship, black, you know, contributions, they refused. And even for the, you know, the lynchings, you know, not to acknowledge that they happen. It's always this hidden stuff that, you know, they think as long as it's not in the public eye, then it really didn't exist. But then when people find out, even little white kids find out, they are like outraged. They feel betrayed.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking, like, this whole orchestrated thing of, like, let's just, every chance we get, let's just hide it, let's destroy it, and it'll be, you know, we'll live happily ever after, which reminds me of the whole MAGA thing, Let's Make America White Again, which, when you talk about the 14th Amendment, that's some scary stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because if you start rescinding laws that actually were enacted in the first place to protect citizenship, to protect human beings, what will you have left after all of that gets gutted?
The 14th Amendment obviously has already been turned inside out, and it was turned inside out in the Harvard case about affirmative action. It framed white people as a protected class from from losing their quote entitled, you know, the admission spots at Harvard or University of North Carolina to which they were entitled. So I think we are in for dark days of 14th Amendment jurisprudence. I also, you know, there's so much in what you say. It doesn't seem obvious on the face of it to me that the way that I would raise my son to be a just and generous and peaceful person is by emphasizing his ancestry. I mean, it seems to me that I would raise my son to be a just and generous person by emphasizing how it is that he relates to other people. And so the idea that somehow teaching little white kids that white people did bad things in the past doesn't, or even that their own ancestors did bad things in the past, I don't see that as that powerful an idea. Right? It seems to me like the powerful idea is to teach people to take responsibility for their own lives at the time in which they're alive, and ask them to remake the world in a more just fashion, rather than to have some kind of, like I say, infantile set of feelings about their ancestors. Seems stupid to me. But that's, you know, again, that's sort of the terrain that we're ending up fighting on for now.
Yeah, but I think it becomes more powerful, Walter, when you try to deny it. Because I'm gonna keep going with I didn't do this or I did that and it's wrong, now I have to stand up.
Let's just be honest about what's happening here is that I'm getting a little bit old and I had forgotten the thing that you said. But the thing that you said is absolutely right, which is that the cover up will enrage and does enrage young people when they find out about it. And it enrages old people when they find out about it. And I will tell you that I have, since I wrote this book, which was now 3 or 4 years ago, I have got plenty of hate mail from angry white people in St. Louis.
I'm sure you have.
But I'll tell you this. I have got 10-to-1 email from people who said, thank you for telling me. Thank you for telling me, I saw this, I saw pieces of it, I didn't understand it, thank you for helping me understand. And I do think that the people who want to repress information, who want to repress history, who want to repress a kind of a notion, an approach to one another, that is decent and loving and just in the way the little kids on playgrounds are, right? When you see 4 and 5 year old kids before they learn all the shit that adults teach them, they're able to negotiate things. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a force, a powerful force to be reckoned with. Now what I will say is that those who are repressing it, they're not susceptible to being convinced by better arguments.
Right.
They're not interested in better arguments.
Yeah, we found that out.
They're interested in the absence of arguments and in rule by force. And so the question is, can can the, you know, the people in the society who are decent and the people in the society who learn things and are shocked by them figure out a way to overcome just the sheer, you know, the outrageousness mm-hmm. of the people who just more and more just want to do things by force.
Yeah, and they're getting more blatant about it because, you know, they got the legislature on their side, the judicial on their side, and so, you know, I think, you know, some of us have to be a bit frightened by the what's going to come in the future, and that's with or without a Trump at the helm. So
I do not believe at this point that the institutions of governance in the United States as they are have the power to self-correct.
No, I believe that. I thought you were getting ready to say something else. I was already ready, but no,
yes, the next step in that argument, you'd have to read the disclaimer again if you want me to say that. I'm in enough trouble now. I'm not gonna follow.
And you are, you know, we could go on and on because I got a ton of other stuff, but you know, we can continue this discussion tomorrow on somebody else's time, because Walter Johnson will be at Washington University, right?
That's right.
Where and what time?
It's at 4 p.m. and, I honestly do not know what building it's in.
Oh, the social work
school. School of Social Work.
Yeah.
School of Social Work at 4 p.m.
4 p.m. And you'll get to hear Walter again if there were some questions that you came up because we don't have an interactive format here yet. You'll get a chance to ask him those questions. Even if it came from this program, I'm sure that there's going to be some overlap.
Anyone in the National Black Radio Hall of Fame listening community is welcome to send me email and ask me questions.
Okay, we thank you, Walter Johnson, for stopping by and talking with us because this, when you talk about an imperial project and really understand it from that standpoint, it does make more sense to me once I read the book and I'm like, But then I think the other thing that really I hadn't really thought about is the focus on Native American removal. I mean, just obsessed with that. I'm like, damn, it's almost, they should be glad that black folks came along because then the focus shifted to us. But it was just like, anything not white and male is going to have to go.
Yeah.
And that's not the society that we are trying to create. I don't care what the Constitution says, but we got to create our own reality here in St. Louis, here in Missouri, here in the U.S., because we are treading on some very, very dangerous kinds of water here. Next week, we're going to have Sandra Keeley, who's going to be talking about the second chance, and that's really one-fourth of black folks in this country who have been incarcerated, who are under incarceration rules, but yeah, there's some things that are going on that are going to really try to take aim at that. So we hope you can join us next week, same time, same place. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. Thank you for listening, and I will see you on the battlefield.
Get in here.
All right. So I'm waiting.